Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Tax Resolution Institute's Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month, and our next call is going to be on August 6th. So please mark your calendars. August 6th is our next Practitioners Forum. Before we get started, I'm going to remind everyone how these calls typically work. You can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you've logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants we have on today, we asked for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. Another reminder is the VIP members of Tax Resolution Institute get priority during these phone calls. So the first series of questions you will hear come directly from our VIP members. And if you want to make sure that you get your questions asked and answered, check out our membership program and see how you can join. All right, so once we get past the questions that were pre-submitted, we will open it up to Q&A session for the rest of you online, of course, time permitting. I suggest you go ahead and either type in your question now because it's first come, first serve, or just indicate that you want to come on live and we will put you on for the rest of us to hear you. Okay, now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin with today's call. Joining us is the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes and bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As the leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Kreisman.
Good morning, everybody. Be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays. Remember, on the first Tuesday of each month, like today, it's Practitioner's Call. As you know, that's a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. On the third Tuesday of each month, we broadcast our featured webinar, learn audits, offers, installment agreements, appeals, and much more. And if you forget what happens when, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And don't forget, we're here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much, Norman. With that said, I'm going to go ahead and get started here with the questions. Actually, you know what? Before I do that, another reminder, we mentioned this last month. We do have our upcoming live event, 8 hours of CPE credit, coming up on November 14th. I'll spend a little bit of time in a few minutes to go over some of the details for the November 14th event. But jumping right in, let's go ahead and take our first VIP member question. This is Francine. She's a CPA, and she's indicating that on previous calls, you've mentioned that we can renegotiate an installment agreement if the payment becomes unaffordable. How do you accomplish this? Do you call ACS with the 433F ready to stop the auto drafts, or do you put a stop payment and wait for the IRS to contact the taxpayer? I'm trying to understand what is more practical and does not negatively impact the taxpayer.
So if you're talking about stopping payment, then I assume that the taxpayer is in a direct debit installment agreement now, maybe a streamline where financials weren't submitted. It was just based on the balance divided by so many months. If that's unaffordable, then you do need a 433F, and you do need to be ready to go through the F with the person on the phone coming up with disposable income that would be less than the current installment agreement. I would also have a 433D ready, which is the installment agreement, because if they're going to change the amount of the monthly payment, they may or may not require a new 433D, but it's always better to have it available so that you don't have to call back again. I wouldn't stop payment. I would just call back with the current financial situation and explain that the amount of the current payment plan is not feasible, and get it down and have a 433D ready to fax, signed by the taxpayers, with the new monthly amount and the routing number and account number of the bank that you want it taken out of.
All right. Now, if they do put a stop payment on it, Norman, isn't the IRS also going to charge them a fee for bouncing a check or a payment on them?
And then you're also going to need another fee for either reinstating or starting a new installment agreement. So you're better off just calling and seeing if you can modify the terms of the existing one.
Correct. All right, Francine, hopefully that helps you there. Moving on to David. David is also a member, and his question is, if a taxpayer had a substitute for return prepared and the IRS is now collecting, should I still file the return? It doesn't look like filing the return will change the liability at all. Are there any pros or cons?
I don't really see a point in filing a return if the SFR is pretty accurate. There's a 10-year statute on collection, and it's 10 years from the date of assessment. So if you submitted a new return at this point and they audited their return and assessed liability to replace the old liability, and it was, you know, within a few dollars one way or the other, that new assessment now has a full 10 years towards collection, where the SFR assessment time is already, some of it is already run, and so the 10-year statute is closer to expiring than a new one. So no, if it's not going to reduce the liability, I really don't see a point. I guess if the taxpayer is contemplating bankruptcy, then there may be a reason to prepare and file the return, but even that's not a sure thing. And it depends where the taxpayer lives, because not all circuits consider a filed return to be a return once an SFR has been filed. So I really don't see much of a reason to file a return at this point.
All right. Moving on to Christine, also a VIP member. Christine's asking, can you explain how the 10-year statute of limitation works on a payroll tax matter? Does it start from the filing date of the return, by quarter, or when the owner was determined personally liable?
Okay. So when you were talking about the owner being determined to be personally liable, I think we're talking about trust fund recovery penalty. And so we're talking about a business like a corporation, because if it's a sole proprietorship, then the sole proprietor owes all the taxes and doesn't need to be determined to be personally liable. They're personally liable from the beginning because it's a sole proprietorship. So let's say it's a corporation, and let's say the owner was determined to be responsible person and assessed trust fund recovery penalty. So the 10-year statute for collection on the trust fund recovery penalty is 10 years from the date of assessment. So there's a notice that goes out that's a notice of proposed assessment of the trust fund recovery penalty, and it gives the taxpayer three options. One option is to sign the notice and send it back, and then the trust fund gets immediately assessed, which I don't really see why anyone would do that unless they're, for some reason, they're in a hurry to have the tax assessed against them. The second thing is to do nothing, in which case the trust fund recovery penalty proposed assessment becomes a final assessment after 60 days. Or the third thing would be within the 60 days to appeal the trust fund recovery penalty, and the notice has instructions on how to appeal it. And so depending on which way they go, when the dust finally settles and the trust fund recovery penalty assessment is finalized, that's 10 years from the date of that assessment.
All right. Just a follow-up question to that. Jacob online, Norman's asking, what about LLC, single member LLCs, in the same scenario with the trust fund recovery penalty?
So if it's a single member LLC, I think they still would do a responsible person, and it would still be a trust fund recovery penalty assessment. But either way, it would still be 10 years from the date of assessment.
Got it. All right, moving on then to Karen. Karen, also a VIP member, is asking, I set up my client on a streamlined installment agreement, and he's made more than the required three payments for the lien to be removed. Now what? How do you remove the lien, and what is the typical timeline for getting it removed? I've never done a lien release and would like to know the general procedure.
Okay. So being in a streamlined installment agreement and getting the lien, first of all, it's not removed and it's not released, it's withdrawn. The only way to release a lien is by paying it off. So if you're not paying it in full, then the lien isn't released, it's withdrawn. And I would have several questions because if you're in a streamlined installment agreement and a tax lien has not yet been filed and you owe less than $50,000, they won't file a lien. If you owe more than $50,000, they will file a lien. And if you pay it down below $50,000, again, they won't. So I don't know if this lien was filed before the installment agreement was set up or if they owed more than $50,000, because otherwise there wouldn't have been a lien filed in the first place. But let's say there is a lien. Well, being in a streamlined installment agreement for 3 months doesn't automatically qualify the taxpayer to ask that the lien be withdrawn unless they owe less than $50,000. So if they owe less than $50,000 and they've been in an installment agreement and more than 3 months worth of direct debits have occurred, the taxpayer can file a form 12277, which is an application for withdrawal of a filed notice of federal tax lien. And on that form, there's a box that you can check. I think it's in section 11. There's a box that says that the taxpayer is in a direct debit installment agreement. Then you would check that. But I'm sorry, in order to qualify for that withdrawal of the federal tax lien under form 12277, the taxpayer has to get the tax below $25,000. So if the taxpayer gets it below $50,000, they can avoid the lien being filed in the first place. If the lien has been filed, then they need to get the balance down below $25,000 and then in an installment, direct debit installment agreement, where more than three payments have been directly debited from the taxpayer's bank account, and they can get the lien withdrawn. So I hope that explains it. So the required three payments isn't enough. They also have to get the balance below $25,000 once the lien has been filed.
Okay, Karen, hopefully that helps you. Quick refresher, $25,000 below. File form 12277, and the IRS will withdraw the lien, not release the lien. Okay, Roger is asking, IRS has selected a couple of the returns I prepared for examination on a longtime client. I have been preparing this family's returns for about 10 years, and this is the first time they've been audited. Nothing out of the ordinary happened the year selected for review. However, the client is nervous because there was a flood in his home and some of the documents were lost. What's the best way to handle this with the IRS?
Okay, so no need to panic yet because, again, you don't know what they're looking at or what they're going to ask for. But if some documents have been destroyed, you could explain that. If there was a flood, maybe there was some kind of insurance claim or something, and you can show the IRS the insurance claim to as proof that they lost property in the flood. Usually these audits are looking at expenses and they're looking at proof of the expenses, and proof is either is both some kind of statement or invoice or receipt, and then a canceled check showing proof that that invoice had been paid. So if you lost the invoices in the flood, maybe you can, it's not too late to go back to the bank and order copies of the canceled checks. So at least you'd have the checks. And then maybe also you could go back to who the checks were written to and see if you can get a copy of the receipt. So that's the way that I would handle something like that. I would get proof that there was a flood and property destroyed through an insurance claim, hopefully was made. And then I would get canceled checks, either copies from the bank and copies of the invoices from whoever issued the invoices, and you should be okay.
All right, Roger, good luck with that. Moving on to Jake, also a VIP member. This question is for your bankruptcy attorney. You're in luck, Jake, because we have Norman here. A client of mine filed for bankruptcy Chapter 11 in 2015 and is currently making payments to the trustee. He started to receive notices of tax due from the IRS for tax years 2016 and 17, which are significant. Can he get the liabilities included in his bankruptcy plan, or can he file for Chapter 7 now? He's not sure of what to do, and his bankruptcy attorney has retired.
Okay, so, I mean, first of all, this is what I always say. Jake, I don't know if you're an attorney or an accountant or an enrolled agent, but if you're not a bankruptcy attorney, the only advice you should be giving your client is to hire one. And if his bankruptcy attorney retired, at least in California, if you're going to wind down a bankruptcy practice, you need to make accommodations for your client. So I don't know if some other attorney has taken over his practice or if he needs to hire another attorney, but he needs to be represented by a qualified bankruptcy attorney. Secondly, normally in a Chapter 11, the debtor is his own trustee. And if he's making payments to a trustee, that tells me that the United States trustee appointed a trustee in his 11, and that's usually not done unless there's some big problems. So there might be some problems in this Chapter 11. Otherwise, a trustee wouldn't have been appointed. Next is he filed in 2015, and he's receiving tax notices for tax years 16 and 17. So those are called post-petition taxes. And in the Chapter 11, the debtor, or at the time the debtor in possession, would have filed a budget, including income and expenses. And that budget would have provided for payment of post-petition taxes. So I'm not sure what happened and that he ended up owing post-petition, but his budget should have provided for full payment of IRS taxes and state taxes during the bankruptcy. So now he's got post-petition tax liability, and the IRS can do one of two things. The IRS is either going to file an administrative claim, which is like a super priority claim, and those 16 and 17 taxes are going to have to be paid in the Chapter 11, or the IRS could file a motion to dismiss the case because the debtor hasn't lived up to the terms of his plan by incurring post-petition tax liability. And now we're already into 2019. So is he going to owe for 2018 too? So the question, can he get the liabilities included in the bankruptcy plan? Yes, if the IRS files an administrative claim, but those taxes are going to be administrative claims, which make them super priority. The other question is, can he file a 7? No, you can only be in one bankruptcy at a time. So he's already in an 11, and I don't think they're going converting to a 7 is necessarily a good idea, but that's something that he needs to talk to his bankruptcy attorney with. And if he doesn't have one, he better get one. So hopefully that answers your question. Is it really depends on if the IRS is willing to file an administrative claim or if the IRS is hell-bent on getting the case dismissed. And then if the case is dismissed, filing a 7 isn't really going to help them because the taxes are going to be not dischargeable anyways because they're going to be priority taxes. So I think what he really needs to do is get his budget together and make sure he doesn't owe any more taxes during the plan.
All right, Jake, definitely a tricky situation there. Hopefully Norman was able to assist you there, pointing you in the right direction. Moving on to our next member. This is Joshua. He's asking, husband and wife clients have joint tax liability due to the husband's self-employment status. If he files for BK, will the IRS go after her W-2 wages to recover the taxes?
Yeah, so I'm really not sure what you're asking. Are you saying, okay, the husband and wife filed, married filing jointly, and so their tax liability is a joint tax liability? Are you saying only the husband would file the bankruptcy? If that's so, I don't know why they would do that, because the husband filing the bankruptcy will not alleviate the wife's joint and several tax liability. So if he files bankruptcy and she doesn't, then yes, the IRS will go after her for the full amount of the taxes because she's jointly and severally liable. And so him filing bankruptcy without her really doesn't solve anything. They can just go after her. And I don't know what state you're from, but in California it gets even worse because they can go after the wife for the full amount, even if it wasn't joint and several liability, even if it was just his, because of community property. And I don't know if they're in a community property state, and different community property states have different rules on this. California is called 100% community property, which means that 100% of the spouse's community property is accessible for the tax. So if you're asking will it help if he files bankruptcy and she doesn't, the answer is no. If they both file, I don't know what they're seeking, how old the taxes are, what the status is, but they could accomplish something possibly by filing bankruptcy. Depends what kind of bankruptcy and what they're looking to accomplish. But if only one of them filed bankruptcy, they could go after the other one for the full amount of the tax. So it really wouldn't help. And if it's in a community property state, they can go after more than just her W-2 wages. They can go after his income too.
All right, Joshua, thank you very much for that question. Moving on to Perry, this is our other VIP member. And Perry says, I just joined and have been watching the videos you made available to me. Wanted to take advantage of the forum and ask a simple question. What if a client doesn't have any assets and no disposable income after completing the financials? Can you just make the offer for, let's say, $500?
So in theory, the answer is yes. In practice, it may or may not be yes. And the reason is because I don't know how the taxpayer calculated no disposable income. Is that based on actual expenses, or is it based on standard allowable expenses? And so even if there's no disposable income based on actual income and actual expenses, there may be disposable income for purposes of an offer if the IRS uses allowable expenses. The other thing is the no disposable income may be a temporary thing. Maybe the taxpayer is unemployed or underemployed, and the IRS would look at his history and determine if, number one, if they're going to be doing income averaging for the prior 3 years because the taxpayer's income is sporadic, or whether they're going to determine that he's probably going to be making more money in the future based on his past. So again, it's possible, but I would need to know more details on the taxpayer's age, health, employment history to determine if this is pretty much the best they're going to do or not, because really what an offer is, it's the IRS doing an analysis to determine the taxpayer's future income and the IRS ability to collect the tax within the lifespan of the statute on collection. And so without more detail, it's impossible to do that. But in theory, yes. And practicality, maybe yes, maybe no.
All right, Norman, thank you very much for that. Perry, thank you very much for becoming a member and joining us there and taking advantage of the additional perks that you get as a VIP member. So now, let me just take a couple minutes to remind everyone of our upcoming event on November 14, 2019. Yes, it is that time again for a full-day event. You do get 8 hours of CPE credit for attending this event. And with this course, you're going to learn to make your most difficult clients your highest source of income, learn how to easily perform the work you dread the most, learn the tips and traps you need to make you a tax resolution expert. So the Tax and Tax Resolution Forum live seminar and webcast is coming up on November 14, 2019, 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern. But if you can't make the live events, we are going to be rebroadcasting these again on the 19th and the 20th, and breaking those up in 4-hour increments. So that way you don't have to attend a full day. You can still take advantage of the event and break it up into 2 4-hour days. I will be sending you a link with the special promo. And as I always do with attendees of these practitioners forum, we're going to offer you an early bird special. The early bird special is 50% off the retail price. So I'm going to be pushing a link. This is specific to you folks, so you will need this link in order to be able to register at 50% off. And just in case you wanted to know what else we're teaching at this event, we are going to be covering all the basic stuff, right? The offers and compromise, installment agreements, innocent spouse relief. But on top of that, we're going to show you how to market your services, how to sell as a professional. We're going to also be dealing with a segment on IRS criminal investigations, tax court petitions, payroll taxes, discharging taxes and bankruptcy. These are all the topics that we'll be covering, including how to stay busy all year long, which is one of the big emphasis that we have, not only for this event, but everything that we put together here is showing you how to not just be a seasonal practice, but be able to continue working all year long and be successful. So again, I'm going to be pushing a link now with the information how to register. Please give us a call if you have any questions or register directly online. I like to say this, operator standing by. But all right, guys, that's enough of that. Let's go on to the rest of the questions. Actually, before I go on to the rest of the questions, I want to let you know that we are coming to the end of the pre-submitted questions. So those of you that are online, and some of you have already done this, go ahead and start typing in your questions. Let us know if you want to come on live and speak to us directly and have the rest of the attendees listen to you. Or just simply type in your question. I'll read it aloud like I've been doing and have Norman answer the questions. Okay, so let's move on. Next question here is from Harvey. I just tried using the online streamline installment agreement request for one of my clients, and it did not accept the payment I requested. I took their liability of $18,000 divided by 72 months and proposed $250. The system rejected it, said the minimum acceptable was $720. Why would that be?
So here's my guess without knowing more. A streamlined installment agreement only works if the payment will full pay the tax liability within the statute for collection. So let's say the taxpayer only owes $18,000, but they owe it for like tax year 2009. And so there's going to be only a year left before the statute expires. So if you were to go into a streamline without submitting financials, they would take the amount that you owe and divide by the number of months left in the statute. So if the taxes are fairly recent, then if you take the $18,000 divided by 72, that would work, but that would only work, you know, if the taxes are, let's say, less than 3 years old. If the taxes are older, then it's not going to work because it won't full pay within the collection statute. So I think the $720 a month is probably because some of the earlier years that they owe for are getting close to collection statute expiring, and so they need more in order to pay. So if you can't afford the $720 a month and you don't qualify for a streamline, then then I would call with a 433F, and you could still get a partial pay. And so it would be based on the taxpayer's ability to pay, and it would, and when the statute expires and is no longer collectible, then they would stop taking the installment payments. So if they don't qualify for a streamline, I would try a 433F and try to get a payment plan that they could afford. But that's probably the reason why, is because the taxes are older and getting close to expiring.
All right, Harvey. I know it's tough to realize these things when you're trying to do what the system tells you to do, but taxpayer has a rough road ahead if they can't afford that payment.
I guess you could order account transcripts and see when the statute is, so you could figure how many months left until the statute expires. Or when you call ACS, simply ask them what the CSET is, and they'll be glad to tell you.
All right, moving on to Henry. My client received a notice from the IRS threatening to take away their passport because of serious delinquent tax liability. How is this enforced? Client has a pending trip and is concerned he may not be able to re-enter the country. Can the IRS do this?
So first of all, it's called a certification of, I forgot the exact word, but it's like certification that they owe a lot of taxes. And I don't think it threatens to take away their passport. I think it says that they won't be able to renew it. So if they have a current passport, they should be okay. It's just they're going to run into trouble when they try to renew the passport. Now, I've seen notices that say that the taxpayer has been decertified, which means that their passport is no longer in jeopardy. And I'm not sure why some taxpayers have been decertified. One thing is, I think if you're in an installment agreement, I think they may decertify you. So you might want to check about, they owe the taxes anyways. And if their passport is being certified, that means that they owe a lot of taxes. And so you probably want to set up an installment agreement for them. And that installment agreement, I think, will decertify them. That's about all that I know about the program. It's been going up and down. And again, we've had clients who have been decertified, and we don't know why.
Okay, moving on to Angela. When completing an IRS 433A or 433F, does the taxpayer have to disclose bank accounts in which he is an authorized signer but not the owner? My client claims to not have any personal accounts but is on a few business accounts.
Yeah, so the thing is, when you say no personal accounts but business accounts, so number one question is, well, what kind of businesses are they? Sole proprietorships, single member LLCs, corporations. So I would need to know what kind of business entities these accounts are. Secondly, if he doesn't have any personal accounts, I'd like to know how he pays, you know, his mortgage or his rent or his utilities. Does he write checks out of these business accounts to pay his personal expenses, or does he get money orders, or how does he pay his personal expenses if he doesn't have a personal checking account? The IRS position is any account in which the taxpayer has signatory rights and can take money out of that account, the IRS can take money out of that account as well. So I don't know if he's using these business accounts as a personal piggy bank or what exactly, but yes, normally you do. And if you look at the 433F and ask for bank accounts, I think there's a box that you check whether they're personal accounts or business accounts. So being a business account doesn't necessarily protect it, and would have to reveal it. A 433A is used when the case has been assigned to a revenue officer, and a 433F is used when the case is with automated collection, ACS. And so I'm not sure what you're trying to accomplish, but why he doesn't have any personal accounts, but only business accounts. But if he's using that for personal expenses, then it's fair game.
All right, Angela, hopefully that helps you there. And moving on to Michael. IRS just denied an offer I submitted earlier this year stating that the taxpayer can full pay the tax liability. My guess is that they are basing their decision on the 2017 filed return. His situation has deteriorated since 2017, as reflected on the offer, and even today is worse still. Can you share how to best appeal this decision? I've never appealed an OIC denial before.
Okay, so first of all, you can appeal a rejection of an OIC, but there's time limits. And so the letter stating that the offer has been rejected also states the appeal rights. I think you have like 30 days from the date of the letter to appeal it, and there's a form that you complete for appeal of a rejected OIC, and you fill in what why you disagree with the IRS decision. So with that rejection of the OIC and the determination that the taxpayer can fully pay the tax liability, there's a couple things. There's one is called an asset equity table, and it shows the taxpayer's assets and equity in those assets, and the value of the equity is part of the offer. But if they're so that's one thing that you may disagree with. The other thing is called an income expense table, and they look at taxpayers' income and allowable expenses and come up with a monthly disposable income, and then they multiply that by the life of the statute to determine what they could collect over the life of the collection statute. Because remember, an offer has to be better than what the IRS could collect over the life of the statute. And so first of all, you need to make that appeal. You don't have a lot of time, so you need to make it quickly. Secondly, you need to look at those two tables that should have been included with the letter. That's the asset equity table and the income expense table. Now, with 2017, maybe he made a lot of money in 2017. And so if you look at the income expense table, the income is going to show more than what the 433A OIC showed. But if that's not accurate, then you're going to appeal it and say that 2017 was a fluke. You know, maybe he's some kind of commission salesperson and he just had unusually high sales that year, but 18 went back down, and you can show that. So you don't have to guess why they rejected it or guess that they're basing it on 17 return. Just look at the income expense table, and that will tell you why they came up with their belief that the taxes could be paid in full. It's either going to be in one of those two tables or a combination of both. So you need to go through those tables, compare them to the 433A OIC that was submitted, and explain why the 433A OIC is correct and the analysis is incorrect.
All right, Michael, hopefully that helps you there. Moving on to the next question here. This is Amy. I submitted and got approved an OIC for an IRS liability of $75,000. We settled for $12,000, but the IRS wants a collateral agreement for the next 5 years. Is this common? Can you explain how this really works?
Right. So it is common. And the reason that the IRS sometimes wants a collateral agreement is because the taxpayers' income is either sporadic or for some reason the IRS believes that the taxpayer's income is going to increase within the next 5 years. Because remember, an offer is based on the IRS analysis of future income. And so if the IRS determines that the information submitted in the 433 AOIC wasn't completely accurate because that happened to be a slow year for the taxpayer and he's had better years in the past, they can either do a income averaging, which is averaging the prior 3 years' returns that may show more annual income than just the final return used for the offer. Or they can do the collateral agreement, which says that if the taxpayer makes over a certain amount of money over the next 5 years, then they're going to want more in the offer. And it spells out like usually a percentage. So if the taxpayer has been making $50,000 a year, it's going to say if in the next 5 years, what anything that he makes over $50,000, a certain percentage is going to go to the IRS for increase offer. So it is common when the taxpayer either has fluctuating income or for some reason believes that the taxpayer's income is going to increase in the next years. I mean, let's say the taxpayer is going to school and you know, working at the school cafeteria now. So his income is low, but when he graduates, he's going to get a good job and pay, you know, make a lot more money and he'll be able to pay it. So it's really looking at the situation and the IRS determining that taxpayer is going to be making significantly more income in the future.
All right, moving on to the questions that are being submitted now online. Another quick note, we are out of the pre-submitted questions, so we are going to be reading these questions from the people submitting online. Next one is from Frank, and Frank is saying, or asking, will the IRS accept an OIC for liabilities stemming from payroll taxes? If so, is it the same criteria for the individual?
So, again, I'm not sure who's submitting this offer. Is it an individual who was assessed trust fund recovery penalty? Because it doesn't say, it says liability stemming from payroll taxes, not from payroll tax. So I'm not sure if it's trust fund recovery penalty. Yes, trust fund recovery penalties can be compromised through an offer. If it's payroll taxes because the taxpayer was a sole proprietor and got assessed the entire payroll tax liability, usually yes, but then you'd want to know, is the business, the sole proprietorship, still operating or is it out of business? But, or is the business operating and is it an in-business offer and compromise? So
Frank is saying it's a trust fund recovery penalty.
Okay, so trust fund recovery penalty is simple. It's the same criteria as any other offer. And so the only difference is if it's solely trust fund recovery penalty and the trust fund recovery penalty, for instance, was only assessed against the husband because the husband was determined to be a responsible person and the wife wasn't, then there's questions about is it a community property state and does the wife's income need to be included in the offer? Also, if the taxpayers are married Sometimes you see where they're married and the husband and wife owe joint liability for payroll, for income taxes, but the husband, in addition to the joint liability for personal income taxes, also owes trust fund recovery penalty. In that case, you need to submit two separate offers. One offer for the wife for the personal income tax, and another one for the husband for personal income tax and trust fund recovery penalty. So there are some tricks, but yes, trust fund recovery penalty can be added in an offer.
Thank you, Norman, and thank you, Frank, for asking. Beatrice is asking, if the IRS issues an SFR and the taxpayer eventually files an original return for the same year, from what date does the collection statute of limitations begin to run? SFR date or the filed date of return?
Neither. So the collection statute always runs from the date of assessment, not the date that the return was filed. And so if an SFR was issued and tax was assessed, then that liability begins to run the date of the assessment of the SFR. If they later file an original return and tax gets assessed based on the original return, that's a new assessment. And I don't know if that, I'd have to see the transcript, because if they owe more, then that second assessment could just be for the additional amount. And so you'd have two collection statutes. You'd have the collection statute for the SFR and collection statute for the additional tax based on the return. If the return showed less tax, then that assessment would reduce the tax, and that assessment would begin a new collection statute, and the original collection statute would be moot. So that's why it's not always wise to file a return after an SFR, because you're creating a new collection statute. So it really depends on how much tax the original return reduces the SFR. You need to look at that before you file.
All right. Thank you very much, Beatrice. And Norman, I'm going to try to address additional questions here. And Dana, you just submitted a question that I'm going to try to explain here, because I don't understand the term you mentioned here. But anyways, she says, Dana's saying, I had an audit for a couple who each had small businesses. They gave their accounting short shrift, so they were assessed approximately $16,000 based on poor accounting. The IRS auditor completed the audit and submitted it for review on 3/27. To date, we have not heard that the review was completed, so should we be worried IRS might reopen the audit and send it back to the IRS auditor?
Okay, so I'm not sure what you received in March, like a 30-day letter or what exactly, but I mean, the way it works is they do an audit report and they send that report with a letter stating if you agree, you don't need to do anything, or you can sign. I think if you agree, you sign off on it and send it back that you agree. If you don't agree, then you don't sign it and send it back. And you could send a letter to the auditor explaining why you don't agree, and they may relook at it or send it to their manager and either agree with you and modify the report or not. If they don't agree with you, then they'll issue the notice of deficiency, and the notice of deficiency then gives you 90 days to appeal by filing a petition in U.S. tax court. So I wouldn't be too worried at this point because it takes a while. But what you really want to keep an eye out for is the notice of deficiency, which is also called the 90-day letter, because it gives you 90 days to appeal to the U.S. tax court. And if you don't appeal within the 90 days, then the tax court loses jurisdiction and you can't appeal to the tax court.
Dana's saying that she hasn't received the 30-day letter. She said that they received nothing from the auditor yet.
Yeah, so
that's what she's worried about.
I mean, you can call and find out, but I wouldn't. It usually just takes a while. The auditor may have sent it to the manager for review or something, but we've had a problem like that before too. Or the auditor's just so busy or whatever. I mean, you could call and ask, but I wouldn't be too worried, because if you haven't gotten the report, the 30-day letter, you're a long way off from having to do anything.
Got it. All right, Dana, thank you very much for submitting your question. Moving on to the next question here. This is from Jessica, related to filing an amended return if a refund was due. That credit balance would be applied to other year's balances, even if past the 3 years to receive a refund, correct? So she's talking about the statute of limitation for refunds, which is three years. Right. She's wanting to know if it's beyond the 3 years, will they still apply it to the past liabilities?
So, yeah, there's kind of two statutes. One is for getting a refund, and one is for them applying the refund to other years. Those other years would have to be less than 3 years. But then there's another statute. I'm not sure what it is, but it could be so old that the refund is not either refundable, let's say in cash, by that I mean a check to the taxpayer, or allowed to be used as credit to offset other liabilities. So there's kind of two statutes. They have a little more time to apply it to other years, but those other years have to be more current, not older than the refund.
Got it. Janesh is asking, when do you know when to do an offering compromise versus an installment agreement? What's the criteria?
Yeah, so first you would do like a 433 something, doesn't really matter, and you would look and determine, does the taxpayer have assets? Do the assets have equity? And then you would look at income and expenses and say, how much disposable income is there? And also, in an offer, they're going by allowable expenses, not actual expenses, where in an installment agreement, there's a little bit more wiggle room, and either they'll allow expenses that exceed the standards, or they'll give you time. It's called the one-year rule, to get those expenses in line. And so you'd have to look and determine what the disposable income is and how that was arrived at, and if the expenses were all within standards, or if some of the expenses exceeded standards. And you'd also look at the statute on collection and see how old the taxes were and how soon they'll be uncollectible.
Now, maybe we can leave them on one note, Norman. Common practice here in our firm is not to do the installment offers, the 12, 24 month.
Oh, yeah. So there's two kinds of offers. There's one called lump sum payment, where you agree to pay the lump sum within, let's say, 6 months of the date that the offer is accepted. And you also make a 20%, I think, down payment. The other one's called a periodic payment. And you start making payments immediately. And you pay all the time that the offer is pending. And then if the offer's rejected, basically that money is gone. And if the offer's accepted, then you continue making those periodic payments for years to go. We don't submit periodic payment installment agreements because you end up paying more, and offers take usually a year to 2 years to be accepted. And so you've been making payments for a year or two. Ultimately, the offer may be rejected, and you end up paying more. So we only submit lump sum payment offers.
Yeah, taxpayers or clients are usually concerned, am I going to be able to come up with the large down payment? But the benefit there is you have dead time to be able to save up while your offer is being reviewed. So the recommendation is always use that downtime to save up or accumulate enough. And then after it's approved, you're still going to get the 5 to 6 months.
Because it's going to be a year or two until the offer gets accepted. And then you have 6 months from there. And so hopefully you've been putting money aside while the offer's pending so that when it is accepted, you're in good position to pay it off within the 6 months.
Right, and you don't have to make double the offer because I think the calculation doubles the offer amount based on disposable income and assets.
Right, right.
All right, guys. Well, that's it for this month's Practitioners Forum. Thank you all for submitting your questions ahead of time and for those of you who came online and asked your question there. We are here to help you address these questions and, again, make you more proficient on anything or all things tax resolution related. Reminder, the upcoming event on November 14th, I did push in the chat box the link to sign up for our early bird special. I'm going to leave that up, and I'm going to push it again here shortly so that you all have it. But again, thank you for joining us. The next Tax Tuesday Practitioners Forum is on August 6th. So again, please mark your calendars, and we thank you for your time. Hope you have a great 4th of July weekend. Everyone be safe, and we'll talk again in August. Thank you.